In opening today, can I say I think it's an exciting time to actually be the Minister for Resources and Energy in Australia. And I say that because resources and energy are the engine room of the Australian economy. They are also part of what is driving economic growth in an unprecedented way in the global community. Can I also say on behalf of the government they are vital to our own future economic growth. They are also the key to the economic growth of our near neighbours and their ability to lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. In that context, energy security, I believe, is one of the big issues confronting Australia and the world today. I simply say that because whoever controls access to energy resources controls economic growth. Much that happens to Australia happens beyond our horizons. As the rise of China and India reshapes the global economy, Australia is simultaneously reaping huge rewards and paying a heavy toll at the same time. Our mineral exports are generating huge economic opportunities and wealth. However, we also appreciate rocketing global demand for oil and energy are affecting the costs of living faced by ordinary Australians in the 21st century. It's therefore time for us to recognise that record oil, petrol and diesel prices are a global problem that with causes largely beyond our national horizons. Just think about the following issues. Global fears about energy security today are fuelled by, for example, instability in exporting nations, the threat of terrorism and infrastructure sabotage, such as Nigeria, resource nationalism, lack of investment, unprecedented global growth and a scramble for resources, a tight oil market, less supply than demand, and the fundamental desire of nations to protect their own economic future. Ladies and gentlemen, when it comes to energy, particularly oil, and increasingly gas, the world is retreating from the open markets and free trade we have worked so hard to achieve since the Second World War. In our region, for example, 55% of Asian consumption is in markets with some form of subsidy. Globally, those subsidised markets account for over 16% of consumption. On top of that, 85% of global oil demand growth is in China, India and OPEC, mainly subsidised markets. The challenge of dealing with energy subsidies in our region is therefore a serious challenge to the Australian government. I note that Malaysia yesterday announced a subsidy cut which will result in a 40% rise in petrol prices. Indonesia last month raised fuel prices 30%, and yet they are still around 65 cents per litre. India and Vietnam are also appropriately now considering action. Thailand appears to be considering more subsidies. China has said that it has no plans to remove price caps. However, with increased demand needing to be fuelled almost entirely from imports, Asian economies subsidising energy prices will face increasing budget and balance of payments pressure. On the other hand, raising prices will further release the inflation genie. Given that both demand and GDP growth over the past few years has been strongest in those Asian economies, with artificially low prices, a question also therefore remains about the extent to which cheap fuel is underpinning their growth. In theory, rising oil prices should reduce demand, but if prices are capped, then it's obviously not going to occur. On the supply side, more producing countries are nationalising their oil industry, sending away vital foreign investment and industry capability. The world's biggest producers are unstable, such as in areas of the world as the Middle East, Russia and Africa. OPEC capacity today is still below what it was in the 1970s. The Middle East has nearly two-thirds of the world's proven crude oil reserves, yet only one-third of current crude oil production. This means that the world will increasingly rely on this region for its oil needs. After the oil shocks in the 1970s, the world enjoyed a limited period when non-OPEC supply increased and provided some competition in the international market. Today, however, Non-OPEC supply is past its peak, which was in 2006. While there have been some big fines recently, for example in Brazil and the Gulf of Mexico, they are in deep water and will be clearly highly expensive to develop. In 2007, effective non-OPEC supply growth was only 100,000 barrels a day for the third year in a row. Growth in 2008 is likely to be zero. There is also limited access to over 85% of the world's proven reserves. This means that on the global stage, the big international oil companies are minor players compared to the national oil companies and OPEC. Ladies and gentlemen, one might ask why this matters to Australia. Despite the fact that we are all reliant on oil imports, we are also a major energy export of coal, natural gas and uranium. Australia is one of the world's energy superpowers, a very sobering reality that comes with enormous responsibility, not only to our own energy security, but also for energy security of the region in which we live. Almost 20% of our nation's exports are energy resources, and this proportion is growing. Australia therefore not only has to look to its own future when it comes to energy security and cleaner energy sources and technology, it has to be part of the solution to economic growth in the region. As I have outlined today and in past speeches, the prices of oil, petrol, diesel and jet fuel, on which our nation is so reliant, are the results of factors largely beyond our control as a nation. The Australian Government is therefore committed to achieving energy security through open and transparent global markets for energy trade and investment. However, I must also acknowledge there is a long way to go in achieving that outcome. So far, no international forum has been able to deal successfully with issues like oil prices and energy security. I note that the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown only last week described current events as, and I quote, the third great oil shock of recent decades. As every country faces increased costs, it is now understood that a global shock on this scale requires global solutions. This is why the United Kingdom is arguing that at the top of the economic agenda for the forthcoming G8 summit in Japan should be a global strategy for addressing the impact of higher oil prices. Our Prime Minister Kevin Rudd has extended the Australian Government's support for this initiative and committed to working cooperatively in the international forums to address the challenge arising from the rising price of oil. It is therefore my intention, in association with my fellow ministers, the Minister for Trade, Simon Crean, and the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Stephen Smith, to seek to reinvigorate the energy security agenda for Australia and the region. We will seek to use the APEC Energy Working Group and the East Asian Summit Energies Cooperation Task Force to start pursuing this discussion. We believe that only through open markets can we send the right signals to industry and consumers. And so together with my colleagues, we will pursue regional cooperation to achieve greater deregulation of global energy markets. But of course, our energy security as a nation also depends on what we do at home. The country at present does not have an energy security strategy at all. Every other country is focusing on such a strategy. As the Prime Minister recently said, the Howard Government developed no long-term energy security strategy for Australia. We clearly need one, and one which embraces all the alternative energy options for Australia in the 21st century. By way of example, as recently as 2003, Australia enjoyed a trade surplus in oil and refined products. Yet today, Australia has a trade deficit in these products, which was already beyond $7 billion, and this is expected to grow to $25 billion within the next decade. We believe that, as a government, we have to start a discussion on the merits of the various energy options available to us as a nation. It is a legitimate debate, It is one that is long overdue. I can also say, in talking about these issues today, we must appropriately focus on the challenge of climate change. And I simply say that no discussion of energy security can occur in terms of energy policy without addressing climate change. The most significant challenge facing the energy sector and the Australian community. The government is serious about acting responsibly on climate change. We have clearly committed to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by 60% on 2000 levels by 2050. To meet this target, a range of measures will be required. Firstly, an emissions trading scheme. Secondly, greater research, development and faster deployment of clean energy technologies. And thirdly, a focus on energy efficiency and conservation. The Australian government will pursue these measures in an economically responsible, measured and methodical way. We are committed to reducing emissions with the least economic cost while maintaining reliable and affordable energy security supplies and our international competitiveness as a nation. The last thing we need is to put perverse incentives in place which actually lead to a leakage of greenhouse emissions in the context of losing Australian jobs overseas. Let's go to the National Emissions Trading Scheme. Design of the scheme is arguably the most important challenge of the government's first term, and I will continue to work closely with my colleague, Senator Wong, who as the Minister for Climate Change is leading this process. My department is part of that process as a leading role in helping bring low-emission fossil fuels and renewable energy technologies to life. That includes overseeing $1 billion worth of low-emission and renewable energy technology initiatives through three clear funds: a National Clean Coal Fund of $500 million, a Renewable Energy Fund of $500 million, and thirdly, the Energy Innovation Fund focusing on solar technologies and hydrogen of $150 million. We believe that as good global citizens, it is in our environmental interest to accelerate the development of technologies that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and that's what we are about. Our $15 million commitment to second-generation biofuels is a further investment which will help the industry avoid the conflict between food and fuel, hopefully. Geothermal energy has the potential to contribute baseload electricity, which is central to this debate, to Australia's energy supply without generating greenhouse gas emissions. The Renewable Energy Fund also includes $50 million dedicated, therefore, to the development of the geothermal industry through the geothermal drilling program. With the support of the government, it is hoped that these projects will become contributors to Australia's long-term energy supply and greenhouse gas reduction strategy. But it also involves not just innovation, but exploration. Australia, as we all appreciate, is oil poor, but gas and coal rich. We need to do more with our abundant coal and gas reserves. We also have to find more oil, and I believe it is a great challenge to find the next Bass Strait or anything like it. The Australian government appreciates that Australia faces strong competition from other nations offering alternative petroleum exploration and project development opportunities. In this context, the government is at the moment preparing a national energy security assessment, which will lead to an energy white paper to put in place, hopefully, the policies necessary for Australia's long-term energy security. Geoscience Australia, one of my responsibilities, is central to that project, and that is involved in doing pre-competitive work to encourage commercial exploration in our extensive new frontiers, both onshore and offshore. We have already committed to the development, and there's consultation underway, of a flow-through share scheme, which is about helping small and medium-sized explorers, and we are looking at a broader range of incentives to promote exploration. And one of those challenges is clearly the cost of deep water exploration. But we also have to develop the resources that we have found. Oil and gas production and processing is a highly capital intensive business, and the construction costs, as we all appreciate in the current global community, are growing rapidly. To address this issue, the Prime Minister has put in place the Henry Review of the Taxation System. I note that includes an assessment of the barriers to investment in large-scale downstream gas processing projects in Australia, the particular hurdles faced by remote gas developers, and construction of the future energy policy framework for new sunrise industry investment in Australia's gas projects, including new LNG and gas-to-liquids projects. That could include new projects such as Gorgon, Browse and Sunrise, which are at the moment struggling to get off the ground, and it's therefore time potentially to even up the playing field for investment in Australia. When you think about it, it's a sobering thought that despite enormous global demand for gas over the last couple of years, and with dozens of gas projects on the drawing board, only two projects have received final investment go-ahead anywhere in the world. One is the Pluto project here under construction in Australia at the moment, and the other is in Angola. I therefore remind you that it is now 7 years since the then Senator, since the then Minister for Resources, Senator Minchin, appointed a gas to liquids task force to investigate the feasibility and benefits of establishing a gas to liquids industry in Australia. Unfortunately, no action was taken to seriously explore those potential developments and therefore potentially reduce our reliance over time on imported oil and fuel, which is about our future. It was also 5 years since CSIRO produced a report entitled The Energy and Transport Sector Outlook to 2020, which laid out its proposed strategy for Australia's transport future. It was a strategy that identified gas to liquids and coal to liquids as central to Australia's future transport fuel security. Alternative fuel industries are emerging beyond Australia. I simply say that we must seriously look at this. I say that because the potential to convert some of our vast gas and coal resources to synthetic fuels like clean diesel is significant, and I am pleased to see a number of major international companies now encouraging interest in this industry and seriously engaged in discussions with my department. I appreciate that engagement. I also suggest that while we are oil challenged, Australia is a world-class gas province. We have been finding gas faster than we produce it for a quarter of a century, and we have well over 110 years worth of remaining resources at today's production rates, and significantly more if we include the vast potential of coal seam methane, which is attracting huge interest in Queensland at this very moment. Energy security is absolutely critical to Australia's economic prosperity, and I believe coal to liquids and gas to liquids will play a major role in determining Australia's energy future. But I'm not the first Labor Resources Minister to hold that view. I know that a former Resources Minister, one Paul Keating, was a great advocate of coal to liquids and gas to liquids technologies a quarter of a century ago. It's about actually getting back on message and having a serious look at some of these issues. But I note that, in my view, things are different today. The industry is real. It is taking off, and ultra-clean gas-to-liquids diesel is in the global marketplace today, attracting significant premiums. The product is becoming highly sought after, with high cetane for better performance, zero sulphur, and low aromatics for cleaner burning. Gas-to-liquids plants are in Qatar and Malaysia, supplying significant markets in Europe and Thailand, with Shell selling gas-to-liquids diesel in terms of blends to over 3,000 retail sites. South Africa has had coal to liquids for more than 50 years, and China is currently constructing its first plant, which will produce 20,000 barrels a day. Coal to liquids and gas to liquid markets are working with major automotive manufacturers in California and Europe on engine and product development, which delivers better performance and efficiency and lower emissions. Leading companies like Cummins, Bosch, Daimler, Renault and VW are involved in these projects, and seriously interested in the future of this high-quality diesel product. Ladies and gentlemen, more importantly, cold liquids will soon be real here in Australia with Link Energy's pilot project at Chinchilla in Queensland. I'm pleased to say that my department and office are in contact with several proponents of this technology and working with them on a gas to liquids and coal to liquids action agenda. Can I say in conclusion that we clearly have major challenges ahead of us as a nation, but also believe that there is much that we can do as a nation, both at home and internationally. And we must do that to not only secure our own future, to be also part of the solution of the problems confronting the global community. The Australian community, the Australian government, is committed to policies that help us find more oil and also to do more with our vast natural gas, coal seam methane and coal resources. We are a fossil fuel dependent economy and we have to front up to these challenges. We're also committed to working cooperatively with our neighbours in the Asia Pacific Forum to achieve open and transparent global energy markets, the same way in which in Labor in government during the 80s and 90s break down barriers in terms of globalisation, we accept there is a new challenge for the Rudd Labor government. I appreciate the opportunity of raising these complex issues with you this morning. Thank you.